This is the Pearson EdExcel International GCSE as a Second Language, Paper 2, Listening Test, June 2021. This test is in four parts, and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the end of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all four parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Part 1. Section A. In this section, you will hear five short extracts in which people are suggesting how to spend a day at the beach. Read the list of suggestions below, then listen to the extracts. For questions 1 to 5, identify which suggestion A to H is being described by each speaker by marking a cross for the correct answer. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. Not all suggestions are described, and each suggestion may be used more than once. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions. Part 1. Section A. Speaker 1.
These can be as simple or as elaborate as you like to make them. All are fun to build. You do not need any special tools, just a bucket to carry water, your hands, and your imagination. You might need a small spade to dig a moat once you have finished, to protect your castle from the rising tide.
Speaker 2.
This is very satisfying and cheaper than the food served by cafes on the beach. You can pack all your favourite snacks and food. Once you have added some fruit and a salad, you have a healthy, fun meal by the sea. However, be careful when playing in the sand nearby, as there is nothing worse than a sandwich covered in sand.
Speaker 3.
If you are not the type to be just lazing in the sun, there are plenty of more energetic opportunities to make the day go by quickly. Bring along a ball and have a volleyball match with friends on the beach or in the sea. Try a hula hoop contest to see who can keep the hoop going the longest.
Speaker 4. Pick up your mobile phone and start photographing the beautiful scenery around you. The wet glistening sand or the white-tipped waves. Look along the beach. There will be plenty of colourful umbrellas. Photograph interesting things like seashells. Capture some amazing sunsets. Creative photos make the best albums, and friends will wonder who the photographer was. Speaker 5.
Want to stretch your legs and unwind? Then go down to the water's edge. Whether you take a leisurely stroll or do something more energetic, like a brisk jog, the sand is great for exercising your legs and feet. The sound of the surf and the smell of the salt water will clear your mind and make you feel relaxed.
Now listen a second time and check your answers. Speaker 1.
These can be as simple or as elaborate as you like to make them. All are fun to build. You do not need any special tools, just a bucket to carry water, your hands, and your imagination. You might need a small spade to dig a moat once you have finished, to protect your castle from the rising tide.
Speaker 2.
This is very satisfying and cheaper than the food served by cafes on the beach. You can pack all your favourite snacks and food. Once you have added some fruit and a salad, you have a healthy, fun meal by the sea. However, be careful when playing in the sand nearby, as there is nothing worse than a sandwich covered in sand.
Speaker 3.
If you are not the type to be just lazing in the sun, there are plenty of more energetic opportunities to make the day go by quickly. Bring along a ball and have a volleyball match with friends on the beach or in the sea. Try a hula hoop contest to see who can keep the hoop going the longest.
Speaker 4. Pick up your mobile phone and start photographing the beautiful scenery around you. The wet glistening sand or the white-tipped waves. Look along the beach. There will be plenty of colourful umbrellas. Photograph interesting things like seashells. Capture some amazing sunsets. Creative photos make the best albums, and friends will wonder who the photographer was. Speaker 5.
Want to stretch your legs and unwind? Then go down to the water's edge. Whether you take a leisurely stroll or do something more energetic, like a brisk jog, the sand is great for exercising your legs and feet. The sound of the surf and the smell of the salt water will clear your mind and make you feel relaxed.
That's the end of Part 1, Section A. Now turn to Part 1, Section B. Section B. In this section, you will hear a short talk on the latest type of bicycle, the electronic bike or e-bike. For questions 6 to 10, listen and answer the questions below. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Regular exercise is incredibly important. Cycling is a perfect form of aerobic activity and is known for being great for overall fitness. Whether you are a committed cyclist or just thinking about taking it up, making sure you have the correct bike for your needs is very important. And this is where e-bikes come into their own. As a cyclist, I am often asked, am I cheating if I use an e-bike? Cheating at what? Enjoying yourself? Arriving at your destination without feeling hot and uncomfortable? Unless you are competing in the Tour de France, e-bikes are just like any other bike. Sure, your legs don't get the workout they would if you were pedaling fully under your own steam. However, an e-bike can open up all sorts of possibilities. Whether it's to extend a regular favourite ride to take in more scenery or to plan a long-distance adventure somewhere entirely new. The battery on a typical e-bike is good for 75 miles before it needs recharging. The ride feels strange at first. You pedal as normal and, depending on the level of assistance or setting, the motor delivers an extra boost. It almost feels as though you are being pushed from behind. The turbo setting is most fun, because once you crank it up to max, cycling uphill is like flying. You can, of course, switch off the motor and pedal unaided. People often ask me how best to use the e-bike. The rear rack means that you can carry cycle bags, so a long-distance ride is just as feasible as a quick trip to the local shops. This does not really sound like cheating to me. E-biking is like any other cycling, only it's more convenient and, I would say, enabling, as it lets me do things I would not have normally considered. It's time to start ignoring that feeling of guilt about riding an e-bike.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Regular exercise is incredibly important. Cycling is a perfect form of aerobic activity and is known for being great for overall fitness. Whether you are a committed cyclist or just thinking about taking it up, making sure you have the correct bike for your needs is very important. And this is where e-bikes come into their own. As a cyclist, I am often asked, am I cheating if I use an e-bike? Cheating at what? Enjoying yourself? Arriving at your destination without feeling hot and uncomfortable? Unless you are competing in the Tour de France, e-bikes are just like any other bike. Sure, your legs don't get the workout they would if you were pedaling fully under your own steam. However, an e-bike can open up all sorts of possibilities. Whether it's to extend a regular favourite ride to take in more scenery, or to plan a long-distance adventure somewhere entirely new. The battery on a typical e-bike is good for 75 miles before it needs recharging. The ride feels strange at first. You pedal as normal, and depending on the level of assistance or setting, the motor delivers an extra boost. It almost feels as though you are being pushed from behind. The turbo setting is most fun, because once you crank it up to max, cycling uphill is like flying. You can, of course, switch off the motor and pedal unaided. People often ask me how best to use the e-bike. The rear rack means that you can carry cycle bags, so a long-distance ride is just as feasible as a quick trip to the local shops. This does not really sound like cheating to me. E-biking is like any other cycling, only it's more convenient and, I would say, enabling, as it lets me do things I would not have normally considered. It's time to start ignoring that feeling of guilt about riding an e-bike.
That's the end of part one. Now turn to part two. Part two. In this part, you will hear a person talking about recycling furniture. For questions 11 to 18, listen and complete the notes. Write no more than three words for each answer. Questions 19 and 20 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
climate change, disposable plastics, cheap throwaway fashion, and the importance of recycling are all increasingly in the public eye. It has long since been cool to buy vintage clothes or recycled clothes, although this has not been true when buying furniture for the home until now. However, things are changing, and a whole new industry is emerging around pre-loved items. The industry is keen to show how a piece of old and used furniture can be transformed or upcycled to fit a more modern look. Second-hand furniture is no longer just about keeping costs down. It is also a brilliant way to get a unique-looking home with items that can't easily be bought online or in superstores by anyone else. It is normal to have a clear-out of furniture from time to time, but it is wasteful to throw everything away when redecorating. Keeping some of the furniture that perhaps was there when you moved in is a great way to add character and tell the story of the house. A set of old suitcases can be turned into a storage unit. The wood and cast iron base of an early sewing machine makes a unique side table. A tea chest or crate can make an interesting coffee table. Many people think that it will take a lot of imagination to update their old pieces of furniture. Often, all you really have to do is to clean them thoroughly. You can supplement what you have found or bought in a second-hand shop by accepting or exchanging items with friends or family. Surprisingly, often a mix of styles and furniture works very well. They might not have been your original choice for a room, but look unusual. And what is even more important is that they are unique. Bigger brands are finally beginning to wake up to the idea that consumers are willing to buy furniture and then to customize it themselves. A large furniture company painted some of its standard wooden shelves and chairs yellow and blue. It showed how different furniture could look when painted a bright colour. The company's flat pack furniture can be seen in thousands of homes across the country, but we are now being shown how we might add our own touch and make a standard piece special to us. Simple things like handles and stencils show how we can add a bit of fun to existing furniture. Of course, some people will always want the perfect home, carefully styled, colour matched, and furnished with perfect new things. A mixture of furniture that some people enjoy isn't for everyone. But that doesn't mean you can't contribute to reducing waste or encouraging reuse. When replacing furniture, just because you don't want it doesn't mean that someone else won't. Some charities will come to your house, collect your old furniture, clean it, resell it, and use the money they make to help others. It's surprising how big a business reusing has become. The second-hand clothes market is worth billions of pounds and is expected to double within the next 5 years. Consumers have now started taking the same approach to used furniture. Next time you are thinking of buying a new bed or sofa, could you update what you already have? Could you upholster in a different fabric? Or even buy second hand? By updating, you might end up with something more unique and stylish than if you had bought it new, and you will have saved yourself some money. If not, before you dump it, ask if a charity would take it. Then you too can help reduce waste and raise money for a good cause in the process.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Climate change, disposable plastics, cheap throwaway fashion and the importance of recycling are all increasingly in the public eye. It has long since been cool to buy vintage clothes or recycled clothes, although this has not been true when buying furniture for the home until now. However, things are changing, and a whole new industry is emerging around pre-loved items. The industry is keen to show how a piece of old and used furniture can be transformed or upcycled to fit a more modern look. Second-hand furniture is no longer just about keeping costs down. It is also a brilliant way to get a unique-looking home with items that can't easily be bought online or in superstores by anyone else. It is normal to have a clear-out of furniture from time to time, but it is wasteful to throw everything away when redecorating. Keeping some of the furniture that perhaps was there when you moved in is a great way to add character and tell the story of the house. A set of old suitcases can be turned into a storage unit. The wood and cast iron base of an early sewing machine makes a unique side table. A tea chest or crate can make an interesting coffee table. Many people think that it will take a lot of imagination to update their old pieces of furniture. Often, all you really have to do is to clean them thoroughly. You can supplement what you have found or bought in a second-hand shop by accepting or exchanging items with friends or family. Surprisingly, often a mix of styles and furniture works very well. They might not have been your original choice for a room, but look unusual. And what is even more important is that they are unique. Bigger brands are finally beginning to wake up to the idea that consumers are willing to buy furniture and then to customize it themselves. A large furniture company painted some of its standard wooden shelves and chairs yellow and blue. It showed how different furniture could look when painted a bright color. The company's flat pack furniture can be seen in thousands of homes across the country, but we are now being shown how we might add our own touch and make a standard piece special to us. Simple things like handles and stencils show how we can add a bit of fun to existing furniture. Of course, some people will always want the perfect home, carefully styled, color matched, and furnished with perfect new things. A mixture of furniture that some people enjoy isn't for everyone. But that doesn't mean you can't contribute to reducing waste or encouraging reuse. When replacing furniture, just because you don't want it doesn't mean that someone else won't. Some charities will come to your house, collect your old furniture, clean it, resell it, and use the money they make to help others. It's surprising how big a business reusing has become. The second-hand clothes market is worth billions of pounds and is expected to double within the next 5 years. Consumers have now started taking the same approach to used furniture. Next time you are thinking of buying a new bed or sofa, could you update what you already have? Could you upholster in a different fabric? Or even buy second-hand? By updating, you might end up with something more unique and stylish than if you had bought it new, and you will have saved yourself some money. If not, before you dump it, ask if a charity would take it. Then you too can help reduce waste and raise money for a good cause in the process.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part three. In this part, you will hear a radio interview with a successful female engineer. For questions 21 to 25, listen and answer the questions. You do not need to write in full sentences. Questions 26 to 30 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions. Hello and welcome to our programme, Women in Engineering, in which we will be talking about the Women's Engineering Society with its new director, Elizabeth Donnelly. Welcome, Elizabeth. We are delighted to have you come and talk to us about girls becoming engineers. You are, I gather, the head of a society that was formed a century ago to encourage women to take up the challenges of engineering.
Thank you. Yes. And I'm delighted to be leading the Women's Engineering Society into the new century. I'm really looking forward to help showcase the success of women engineers who have gone before us and those who will transform our future.
Let me explain to our listeners the great idea behind your society. You are a charity and professional network of women engineers who inspire and support women to achieve as engineers or as scientists, and as leaders in their field of knowledge and expertise.
That's right. During its centenary celebrations, we will be undertaking a variety of national and local events and activities. Some will be aimed at university students, but many will involve children. Each year, for the last 4 years, we have organized dolly tours as a way to capture the interest of a younger engineering audience by showing on social media current engineers touring with our mascot, Dolly. This year, our Dolly tour takes place during the Engineers of Tomorrow Week to show girls how varied and exciting it is to work in engineering. Last year, we had 150 engineers involved, taking photos of our mascot at work. But we'd love this number to grow even more. In our centenary year, we are asking volunteers to use the doll to show how much engineering has changed over the past 100 years, with the theme, Then and Now.
Excuse me for being a bit surprised, but I thought the mascot was a toy. Am I right? How can a doll about 30 centimetres high help encourage girls to take up engineering?
Our mascot, Dolly, is a very special doll. For a start, she resembles a young girl as much as possible. In her wardrobe, instead of party dresses, she has lab coats, safety glasses, and even a hard hat. She is ready to go onto a building site, into a lab, or out into space. Some of our volunteers have written blogs about their week with our mascot, and there are a number of links you can click on, which I am only too happy to give you after the programme. The things Dolly has taken part in are varied. She has worked laying down railway tracks and studying cells under a microscope. She was the first doll in space when she travelled to the International Space Station alongside astronaut Tim Peak.
It never occurred to me to use something as simple as a doll to encourage girls into engineering. But it makes sense. It really does. Obviously, this is one end of the spectrum. With more and more high-profile women like you who are now engineers, is the Women's Engineering Society still needed?
Oh, definitely. The number of professional women engineers in Britain is around 11%, possibly the lowest rate in Europe. The number of professional women in technical level roles, electricians and mechanics, for example, where job growth is greatest, is much lower. Our aim is that by 2030, our engineering workforce in this country will be 30% women.
Isn't that a bit ambitious? Do you think you will succeed? A doll to encourage little girls to become interested in becoming engineers is great, but surely it is just one aspect of what you do.
Oh yes, without a doubt. Dolly is just a start. Moving further afield, into the world of work, there is much to do to support engineering and technology employers, to encourage and enable women to take up opportunities in all aspects of science and engineering.
And do you think you, as an organisation, can make a difference?
Well, yes, we think we do. Our International Women in Engineering Day continues to raise the profile of women engineers all over the world. The day celebrates the achievements of women in engineering and encourages more girls to consider engineering careers. Our background work, encouraging greater gender diversity, has already made a difference to government policies.
What about schools and universities? How involved are you with them?
I passionately believe that schools and universities need to be aware of the opportunities out there for young women. We organise a sellout annual student conference. More and more student groups link with the Women's Engineering Society, creating a nationwide network of female engineering students. We encourage our members to approach schools to speak about their careers, and we have a list of female engineers who are willing to speak in schools, both primary and secondary.
How do you encourage a young engineer? What else do you do to help?
We offer special awards to young engineers. We speak to the media and campaign to change policies where they impact negatively on women as engineers. The Women's Engineering Society has a rich history, and since 1919, we have worked actively to preserve our heritage and that of pioneering female engineers.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for a fascinating insight into what your charity does. May I wish you, and of course your mascot Dolly, success in your great work. Before we go off the air, here are the links Elizabeth spoke about. Now listen a second time and check your answers. Hello and welcome to our programme, Women in Engineering, in which we will be talking about the Women's Engineering Society with its new director, Elizabeth Donnelly. Welcome, Elizabeth. We are delighted to have you come and talk to us about girls becoming engineers. You are, I gather, the head of a society that was formed a century ago to encourage women to take up the challenges of engineering.
Thank you. Yes, and I'm delighted to be leading the Women's Engineering Society into the new century. I'm really looking forward to help showcase the success of women engineers who have gone before us, and those who will transform our future.
Let me explain to our listeners the great idea behind your society. You are a charity and professional network of women engineers who inspire and support women to achieve as engineers or as scientists and as leaders in their field of knowledge and expertise.
That's right. During its centenary celebrations, we will be undertaking a variety of national and local events and activities, Some will be aimed at university students, but many will involve children. Each year, for the last 4 years, we have organized dolly tours as a way to capture the interest of a younger engineering audience by showing on social media current engineers touring with our mascot, Dolly. This year, our Dolly tour takes place during the Engineers of Tomorrow week to show girls how varied and exciting it is to work in engineering. Last year, we had 150 engineers involved, taking photos of our mascot at work. But we'd love this number to grow even more. In our centenary year, we are asking volunteers to use the doll to show how much engineering has changed over the past 100 years, with the theme, Then and Now.
Excuse me for being a bit surprised, but I thought the mascot was a toy. Am I right? How can a doll about 30 centimetres high help encourage girls to take up engineering?
Our mascot, Dolly, is a very special doll. For a start, she resembles a young girl as much as possible. In her wardrobe, instead of party dresses, she has lab coats, safety glasses, and even a hard hat. She is ready to go onto a building site, into a lab, or out into space. Some of our volunteers have written blogs about their week with our mascot, and there are a number of links you can click on, which I am only too happy to give you after the program. The things Dolly has taken part in are varied. She has worked laying down railway tracks and studying cells under a microscope. She was the first doll in space when she travelled to the International Space Station alongside astronaut Tim Peake.
It never occurred to me to use something as simple as a doll to encourage girls into engineering, but it makes sense. It really does. Obviously, this is one end of the spectrum. With more and more high-profile women like you who are now engineers, is the Women's Engineering Society still needed?
Oh, definitely. The number of professional women engineers in Britain is around 11%, possibly the lowest rate in Europe. The number of professional women in technical level roles, electricians and mechanics, for example, where job growth is greatest, is much lower. Our aim is that by 2030, our engineering workforce in this country will be 30% women.
Isn't that a bit ambitious? Do you think you will succeed? A doll to encourage little girls to become interested in becoming engineers is great, but surely it is just one aspect of what you do.
Oh yes, without a doubt. Dolly is just a start. Moving further afield, into the world of work, there is much to do to support engineering and technology employers, to encourage and enable women to take up opportunities in all aspects of science and engineering.
And do you think you, as an organisation, can make a difference?
Well, yes, we think we do. Our International Women in Engineering Day continues to raise the profile of women engineers all over the world. The day celebrates the achievements of women in engineering and encourages more girls to consider engineering careers. Our background work, encouraging greater gender diversity, has already made a difference to government policies.
What about schools and universities? How involved are you with them?
I passionately believe that schools and universities need to be aware of the opportunities out there for young women. We organise a sellout annual student conference. More and more student groups link with the Women's Engineering Society, creating a nationwide network of female engineering students. We encourage our members to approach schools, to speak about their careers. And we have a list of female engineers who are willing to speak in schools, both primary and secondary.
How do you encourage a young engineer? What else do you do to help?
We offer special awards to young engineers. We speak to the media and campaign to change policies where they impact negatively on women as engineers. The Women's Engineering Society has a rich history, and since 1919, we have worked actively to preserve our heritage and that of pioneering female engineers.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for a fascinating insight into what your charity does. May I wish you, and of course your mascot Dolly, success in your great work. That's the end of part three. Now turn to part four. Part four. In this part, you will hear an extract from a podcast about a city which has undergone many changes. For questions 31 to 33 and 38 to 40, listen and complete the sentences below. Write no more than three words for each answer. For questions 34 to 37, complete the table. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Hi, Richard Malden here. I'm about to see how a city can transform itself from an industrial hub with all the pollution that entails into an oasis of green spaces and pedestrianised walkways. This is my first visit to Oslo, the capital city of Norway. Oslo is the current holder of the European Green Capital Award, which was launched 10 years ago. With Stockholm being the very first winner. This was the city that pioneered the bike hire infrastructure, which is so popular now in many European cities. I'm wondering what precisely this award means in practical terms. After all, what makes a green city? There are many factors involved. Policies of planting trees and creating green spaces on what used to be derelict ground, protecting the existing ones, improving air and water quality, promoting local food production, and increasing recycling. Pedestrianisation of city centres makes a huge difference to the experience of a city. Expanding the cycling infrastructure and promoting the use of electric cars is another important factor in making a city more environmentally friendly. Energy production is also an important factor. Often, it is not obvious when you visit a city how sustainable its methods of energy production really are until you notice the grime that's settled on your face. Vancouver in Canada is, in this respect, one of the greenest cities in the world. Renewable hydroelectricity energy produces 95% of its electricity. Oslo's waterfront has been dramatically transformed over the past decade. The city feels as if it's been reconnected with its soul after decades of shipyard construction, where industry and traffic had created a barrier between the city itself and the waterfront, where Viking settlers established their first agricultural and fishing communities in the 7th century. Traffic density has been greatly reduced by a road tunnel under the harbour. Soon, there will be an uninterrupted, pedestrianised promenade with expansive green spaces and even a beach stretching for 9 kilometres along the waterfront. The inner fjord, once so polluted, has been dredged, an artificial marine life-friendly reef constructed, and its water now is classified as clean. The seawater pool, in an area once spoiled by freight containers, is now a popular summer meeting point. From where I'm standing, I can see forested hills which surround the city and serve as a forceful reminder that 2/3 of Oslo is made up of forests and green spaces. Exploring the city centre later in the day, I'm immediately struck by just how relaxing it feels. The unhurried atmosphere is enhanced by electric trams and bicycles. My taxi driver chauffeured me around the city in his electric car. Last year, 50% of all car sales were of electric cars, and there are now 38,000 of them in Oslo. The city authorities' objective is to make the city centre free of petrol cars. My driver assured me this is happening because of a tax reduction on electric cars to encourage people to buy electric. A leading Norwegian bus company has ordered 100 buses for the city this year as part of this initiative. However, a number of Norwegians are sceptical as they feel this poses problems. There is a shortage of charging points, parking is expensive, and more importantly, the production of some of the components used, like batteries, for instance, is not environmentally friendly. Advised by my taxi driver, I tried one of the new electric kick scooters that can be rented from the roadside using a simple app, and which, alongside bicycles, are part of Oslo's revolution in city transportation. Once I got the hang of it, I was able to look around while travelling and saw everyone, from construction workers to city gents in suits and even a policeman using them. I also learned about another of Oslo's green innovations, an urban farm on a reclaimed industrial site. Archaeologists discovered that centuries ago, this had been a grain field near the waterfront. Made up of cooperatives like the Real Bread Society or the Future of Food Collective, the post-Viking farm is not only about vegetables. It teaches about sustainable meat, home baking, and communal living. A farmer told me, when he was showing me around, that modern farming has lost contact with the soil, and people on the farm are learning to respect it once more. Schools are invited to visit on a regular basis and take part in many of the farming activities. The farm is about sustainable growing and the importance of insects, bees, and biodiversity and working as a community. My hotel, recently opened in downtown Oslo, is part of the food revolution. I was taken up on the roof of the hotel by the man who runs the urban farm and who is passionate about growing organic food in the city. He explained to me how the hotel, with his cooperation, is planning to grow all, and not just some, of its green produce on site. This would include herbs, microgreens, and edible flowers. There are also plans for beehives to be put up on the roof. This means that the hotel will have fresh, organic food with no food miles, no plastic, and no wrapping. I discovered the benefits of this initiative later in the evening at the hotel's excellent restaurant on the 13th floor, which serves not only delicious food, some of it homegrown, but also boasts one of the best views of the city.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Hi, Richard Molden here. I'm about to see how a city can transform itself from an industrial hub with all the pollution that entails into an oasis of green spaces and pedestrianised walkways. This is my first visit to Oslo, the capital city of Norway. Oslo is the current holder of the European Green Capital Award, which was launched 10 years ago, with Stockholm being the very first winner. This was the city that pioneered the bike hire infrastructure, which is so popular now in many European cities. I'm wondering what precisely this award means in practical terms. After all, what makes a green city? There are many factors involved. Policies of planting trees and creating green spaces on what used to be derelict ground, protecting the existing ones, improving air and water quality, promoting local food production, and increasing recycling. Pedestrianisation of city centres makes a huge difference to the experience of a city. Expanding the cycling infrastructure and promoting the use of electric cars is another important factor in making a city more environmentally friendly. Energy production is also an important factor. Often, it is not obvious when you visit a city how sustainable its methods of energy production really are, until you notice the grime that's settled on your face. Vancouver in Canada is, in this respect, one of the greenest cities in the world. Renewable hydroelectricity energy produces 95% of its electricity. Oslo's waterfront has been dramatically transformed over the past decade. The city feels as if it's been reconnected with its soul after decades of shipyard construction, where industry and traffic had created a barrier between the city itself and the waterfront, where Viking settlers established their first agricultural and fishing communities in the 7th century. Traffic density has been greatly reduced by a road tunnel under the harbour. Soon, there will be an uninterrupted pedestrianised promenade with expansive green spaces and even a beach stretching for 9 kilometres along the waterfront. The inner fjord, once so polluted, has been dredged, an artificial marine life-friendly reef constructed, and its water now is classified as clean. The seawater pool, in an area once spoiled by freight containers, is now a popular summer meeting point. From where I'm standing, I can see forested hills which surround the city and serve as a forceful reminder that 2/3 of Oslo is made up of forests and green spaces. Exploring the city centre later in the day, I'm immediately struck by just how relaxing it feels. The unhurried atmosphere is enhanced by electric trams and bicycles. My taxi driver chauffeured me around the city in his electric car. Last year, 50% of all car sales were of electric cars, and there are now 38,000 of them in Oslo. The city authority's objective is to make the city centre free of petrol cars. My driver assured me this is happening because of a tax reduction on electric cars to encourage people to buy electric. A leading Norwegian bus company has ordered 100 buses for the city this year as part of this initiative. However, a number of Norwegians are sceptical as they feel this poses problems. There is a shortage of charging points, parking is expensive, and more importantly, the production of some of the components used, like batteries, for instance, is not environmentally friendly. Advised by my taxi driver, I tried one of the new electric kick scooters that can be rented from the roadside using a simple app, and which, alongside bicycles, are part of Oslo's revolution in city transportation. Once I got the hang of it, I was able to look around while travelling and saw everyone, from construction workers to city gents in suits and even a policeman, using them. I also learned about another of Oslo's green innovations, an urban farm on a reclaimed industrial site. Archaeologists discovered that centuries ago, this had been a grain field near the waterfront. Made up of cooperatives like the Real Bread Society or the Future of Food Collective, the post-Viking farm is not only about vegetables. It teaches about sustainable meat, home baking, and communal living. A farmer told me, when he was showing me around, that modern farming has lost contact with the soil, and people on the farm are learning to respect it once more. Schools are invited to visit on a regular basis and take part in many of the farming activities. The farm is about sustainable growing and the importance of insects, bees, and biodiversity and working as a community. My hotel, recently opened in downtown Oslo, is part of the food revolution. I was taken up on the roof of the hotel by the man who runs the urban farm and who is passionate about growing organic food in the city. He explained to me how the hotel, with his cooperation, is planning to grow all, and not just some, of its green produce on site. This would include herbs, microgreens, and edible flowers. There are also plans for beehives to be put up on the roof. This means that the hotel will have fresh, organic food with no food miles, no plastic, and no wrapping. I discovered the benefits of this initiative later in the evening at the hotel's excellent restaurant on the 13th floor, which serves not only delicious food, some of it homegrown, but also boasts one of the best views of the city.
That is the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklet to be collected. Thank you, and good luck.